A few hundred protesters gathered in Washington, D.C. recently. They voiced an extreme point of view. They believe that vaccines are hurting people. They met with congressional representatives. They demonstrated in front of the White House. They attended a rally. Despite exhaustive science that has found again and again that vaccines are safe, the protesters called their event Revolution for Truth. Here's what some of them had to say.
Kids are getting sicker and sicker. Allergies, asthma, autism.
The last flu shot I had was 1996. I've never been so sick in my life from the flu.
I use Facebook for the sole purpose of spreading vaccine awareness.
Plenty of research that people can do on their own. They don't have to rely on the government to give them answers. We have a thing called the internet now.
I can't get behind faulty, corrupted science.
Show us the science and give us a choice. You say it.
This kind of sentiment is exhausting to public health researchers. They have shown them the science. But it seems the anti-vaccine movement just won't go away. There was a recent controversial documentary on the topic. Hollywood celebrities have gotten on this bandwagon. Even President Trump has taken to Twitter over the years to make dubious claims about vaccines. And with these voices loud and strong, pediatricians and researchers have had to up their game, the way they communicate and interact with patients to counter this all-out anti-vaccine position. Elizabeth Fiedler reports.
Paul Offit doesn't mince words when it comes to speaking out for vaccines. He's been doing it for decades. Offit's director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and he has paid a price for being so outspoken.
It's the rare week that goes by without me getting some form of hate mail. The hate mail usually takes the themes of Nazis and Satans and, you know, going to hell and, you know, watch your back, that sort of thing.
Offit's also been the subject of several lawsuits. And there's more.
I got a phone call from a man who seemed reasonable enough. He said, look, we all want what's best for our children. I want what's best for my child, stating his name and age, and you want what's best for your children. Then he said, the names of my children. He said, the ages of my children. And then he said where they went to school, and then he hung up.
After that call, Offit considered stepping back. But in the end, he kept going. He says it's perfectly reasonable to be a vaccine skeptic, to ask questions about safety, but
what some people become are not skeptics, but cynics, which is to say that they don't believe the data. They think there's just a massive conspiracy to hide the truth, and therefore they shouldn't get vaccines no matter what the evidence shows.
Pediatricians find themselves talking a lot about vaccines and all of the research that shows they're safe.
Just checking on the regular stuff, all the body parts.
Pediatrician Andrew Wood is kneeling over six-month-old Mesa inside her family's living room in Philadelphia. The baby's about to get some shots and is laying on the coffee table for this home visit with the doctor. Wood opens a small black cooler. It looks like an insulated bag you'd pack your lunch in. He pulls out the supplies, fills a syringe from a small vial, and pokes it into Mesa's chubby leg. The usually giggly baby isn't happy about that.
I'm sorry. I know, that one tends to sting a little bit more. Yeah, I do that one last because it usually stings a little bit more than the other ones.
It's a slightly uncomfortable but familiar sound for parents after a vaccine trip. For Maze's father, Samer Aboud, the vaccination reminds him of a different pain experienced by his own father.
My father had polio when he was a kid, and he comes from a community where many people had polio. So he had cousins who had polio. My mother had cousins who had polio. It was actually something that was very common in the village that they grew up in Lebanon.
Aboud says seeing his father's health deteriorate has reinforced his own support for vaccination. His wife, Sonia Rosen, has put out a plate of sweets from a bakery in Morocco her family owns. She feels similarly about vaccines. Having them is a privilege.
The idea that, like, we could even consider not having a vaccine, whereas most of the world, when people have access to vaccines, it's, like, deeply desired, you know, because it can prevent stuff that kills people very easily.
Pediatrician Andrew Wood enjoys these home visits. He no longer has a traditional doctor's office. He spends more time with his patients and is able to forge personal connections with the families in the comfort of home.
He spends a lot of time answering questions.
I see my role more as to not pressure them or force them to do something that they're not comfortable with, but to give them my opinion, my expert opinion, and educate them as much as possible about the vaccines, and then let them make a decision.
For Wood, it's all about his patients making informed decisions.
Right after do no harm, I'd feel like an informed consent's really probably the second most important thing in terms of the values in medicine.
About 5% of his patients don't follow the typical American Academy of Pediatric schedule, or refuse vaccination completely. Still, Wood says most of his patients end up getting their shots by kindergarten. Paul Offit from the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia understands that doctors want to have these conversations with parents about vaccinations, but he wishes they would draw a harder line.
Pediatricians, especially young pediatricians, are going to have to go against their training. I mean, their training is to sort of be open-minded to all sorts of attitudes and beliefs and cultural differences, which is good up to a point, but this is that point. I mean, know that when you send a child out of your office unvaccinated or undervaccinated, that there's a lot of diseases out there that they could get and be harmed by or even killed by.
As a child, Offit had measles, mumps, and chickenpox. In a way, he says, vaccines are a victim of their own success.
Think about it for a second. In the United States, we ask parents to give, in the first few years of life, vaccines to prevent 14 different diseases, which can mean as many as 26 inoculations during that period of time. It can mean as many as 5 shots at one time to prevent diseases most people don't see, using biological fluids most people don't understand.
The absence of these diseases and the fact that most people don't understand vaccines has proven to be fertile ground for misinformation. Of course, you've heard about British researcher Andrew Wakefield's 1998 study that claimed to have found a link between the MMR vaccine for measles, mumps, and rubella and autism. The work was debunked and has since been disproven. 17 studies have shown that the MMR vaccine does not cause autism. The modern anti-vaccine movement was actually likely born long before Wakefield's infamous study. In April 1982, when an NBC TV station in Washington, D.C. aired a special called Vaccine Roulette.
DPT, the initials stand for diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus, 3 diseases against which every child is vaccinated. For more than a year, we have been investigating the P, the pertussis part of the vaccine.
The TV reporter Leah Thompson went on to make inaccurate claims about the shot for pertussis, better known as the highly contagious respiratory disease whooping cough. The program was criticized for using inaccurate statistics and a lack of hard science to back its sweeping claims, like this one.
The overriding policy of the medical establishment has been to aggressively promote the use of the vaccine, but it has been anything but aggressive in dealing with the consequences.
In the days after the program aired, the TV station gave callers the phone numbers of other people who'd already called with concerns about vaccines. The modern-day anti-vaccine movement was born. It spread with the help of the internet and celebrities like Jenny McCarthy and Robert De Niro, both parents of children diagnosed with autism. Back when Paul Offit started working on vaccines in 1980, he didn't envision himself becoming a defender of vaccines. But he says he'll never stop speaking up for vaccination.
We see at least one child in this hospital every year who suffers and occasionally dies from a vaccine-preventable disease, invariably because the parents made a choice not to vaccinate them. It's just a dangerous game to play.
That was Elizabeth Fiedler reporting on vaccines. And listening to her story, I was wondering, have public health researchers learned any big lessons from all of this in terms of dealing with extreme positions? I asked Allison Buttenheim. She's been researching vaccine attitudes for almost a decade, and she looks at this through the lens of behavioral economics. How do people make decisions? What are the biases that influence how we decide?
Humans have this strong tendency towards what we call confirmation bias. So if they're looking for information, their brain is actually going to filter and look for information that confirms what they already know or believe. So even if the CDC or your pediatrician or an internet blog has a lot of great information, your brain won't even see it or pay attention to it. It'll scan to find sources and where you say, aha, see, I'm right. What's on the internet confirms what I already know. Understanding that helps us design interventions that can get around things like confirmation bias.
So if I'm a person who holds the most extreme position on vaccines and I say absolutely will not do it, do not trust anybody, Is there a way you can communicate with me? What have you learned about that?
That's a group that's really hard to reach. And, you know, there have been people who've been vaccine hesitant for as long as there have been vaccines, so 200 years. And we haven't had as much success figuring out how to sort of flip those folks. The group where we probably have more opportunity is where the hesitancy is a little less strongly held, just something they've kind of heard from friends or kind of seen on the internet. They just don't feel quite certain or confident in following, for example, the recommended childhood schedule. That's where a pediatrician or a public health promotion campaign can think about how to frame that information, how to present the information to the parent, maybe think about social norms and social pressure. What are other people doing? That's another important behavioral economic concept. We really like to do what we see other people around us doing. And that's where I think we have ideas and opportunities for new interventions.
So is the real lesson you've learned that perhaps the most important work is to make sure that the most extreme positions do not spread into the middle ground people?
That's a great way to frame it. And we think about vaccine hesitancy or vaccine refusal being contagious, just like the diseases are contagious that we're trying to prevent. And so we look a lot at, for example, how vaccine hesitancy or vaccine refusal is a clustered behavior. We see it clustered in social groups and clustered spatially. And once we think about it like that, we can almost treat it like an epidemic and think about how do we control it? How do we contain it? How do we prevent those ideas from spreading?
Allison Buttenheim researches vaccine attitudes.